I said. As I bent down to pick up the body, and Oberon began playing a macabre game of snout soccer, the battle crow showed up. It took one look at the carnage and squawked angrily at me. "I know," I said in an urgent whisper. "I'm in deep trouble. If you will follow me to the backyard, we should be able to speak privately there." The crow squawked once more before launching itself into the air and flapping over the roof. I hauled Bress off the street and slung him over my shoulder in a fireman's carry. I felt his blood oozing through the back of my shirt. I'd have to burn it. When I got to the backyard, the Morrigan was already in human form, standing pale and silent with her hands on her hips. Her eyes were glowing. This wasn't going to be a nice chat.
"When I agreed to your immortality, that did not give you permission to kill the Tuatha De Danann," she spat.
"Surely I don't need permission to defend myself," I asked. "He tried to use his glamour to cut me down, Morrigan. If I hadn't been wearing my necklace, I never would have seen the sword he pulled on me."
"You would have survived," the Morrigan pointed out.
"Aye, but in what condition? Forgive me if I did not wish to experiment with various levels of pain and disembowelment," I said as I lowered my shoulder and let Bress fall unceremoniously onto the widow's Bermuda grass.
"Tell me precisely what happened, every word that passed between you."
I told her, and she regarded me with stony silence, except for those red eyes. They finally dimmed when I told of how I had used a camouflaged dog to trip him and finish him off.
"Well, that was unforgivably arrogant of him. He deserved to die a fool's death," she said. "And look at that horrendous armor."
But then she looked at his head resting a yard to the right, and her eyes blazed red again.
"When Briett hears of this, she will want me to bring her your head, and I will have to tell her no. Do you know what position that puts me in, Druid?"
"I am sorry, Morrigan, but perhaps if you tell Briett precisely how he died, she'll be less inclined to demand blood for blood. Think of your own reaction to it. His death was the most dishonorable of any of the Tuatha De Danann. And why was he doing Angus's bidding anyway? Demanding restitution for one such as he would be almost ridiculous." Her eyes cooled down as she considered my words.
"You reason well. Perhaps we can avoid conflict if we present it to her properly."
She looked again at Bress's headless body and his head sitting at Oberon's feet.
"Leave the body with me," she said. "I will take care of it."
I was only too glad to let her. "My thanks. If you have no objection, I will go wash the blood out of the street."
"No, go ahead."
The Morrigan flicked her hand dismissively, her eyes still on the body, and I took off before she changed her mind. Besides, I honestly didn't want to see what she was going to do. I grabbed the garden hose attached to the front of the house and turned it on full blast. The widow came out with a glass of lemonade for me and a fresh whiskey for herself, surprised to see me back so soon.
"Have you buried the feckin' teabag already?" she said.
"No," I admitted, and tried to cover my shock at the widow's language. "I just came back to wash the blood out of the street."
"Ah, well then I'll leave you to it,"
she said, handing me the glass and patting me gently on the arm.
"I think it's time for Wheel of Fortune, you know."
"Good night, Mrs. McDonough." She swayed a bit as she searched for the door handle.
"You're a good lad, Atticus, mowing me lawn and killing what Brits come around."
"Think nothing of it, please," I said. "And it's probably best if we kept this between us."
"Of course,"
she said, finally finding the door and yanking it open.
"Good night."
As the door closed behind her, Oberon said,
"You know, I think the television might have desensitized her to violence."
"That or living in Northern Ireland during the Troubles," I said.
"What were the Troubles about?"
"Freedom, religion, power, the usual. Would you mind standing sentinel again on the edge of the lawn while I do this?"
"No problem."
I took out Fragorah first to hose it down, then pointed the spray at the street to wash the worst of the gore away. I was just about finished when I heard Oberon's voice in my head, sounding very tense.
"Hey, you said to listen for heavy footsteps. Well, I hear a whole bunch of them, and I think they're coming this way."
Chapter 10 "Time to go home," I said, throwing down the hose and scrambling back to turn off the water. I hopped onto my bike and told Oberon we were going full tilt. I had to get away from the widow's house or she could become a casualty.
"What's making that noise?"
he asked, his long stride keeping pace with my bike as I pumped furiously to get some speed.
"Those are the Firbolgs," I told him in my mind, saving my breath for bike riding. "I think they sped up. They're running now."
"They've spotted us. Don't look back. Keep going. Now listen, these guys carry spears, but you won't see them. Just trust me, they'll have them. They're not going to see you either. What I want you to do is go for their left legs, that soft spot above the ankles."
"The Achilles tendon? I remember that."
"Good, but you need to go for their calves. These guys are actually a lot bigger than they look, and their Achilles tendons are going to be about where a human's calf would be. I want you to bite them once and then get the hell out of the way before they fall on you or take a swipe at you."
"But what if they're wearing armor?"
"They won't be. Anything you see is an illusion. They're going to be barefoot, most likely. They have pretty tough hides." I risked a look back up Roosevelt as I turned the corner onto 11th. My normal vision showed me 9 assholes in Harley-Davidson riding gear running after me under the streetlights as if I'd just toppled their bikes outside the pool hall. My fairy specs showed me 9 nearly naked Firbolgs wearing nothing but breechcloths and woad. They carried spears in their right hands and large wooden shields in their left, and they were grinning in anticipation because they were gaining on me. When I got to my house, I rode up on the lawn and leapt off my bike, letting it roll riderless up to the porch. I heard a curse coming from the porch, and I drew Fragora from its scabbard, wondering who was lying in wait for me there.
"Damn you, Atticus, what are you playing at?"
a familiar voice said as my bike came to an abrupt halt and then got tossed half the distance back to me. I felt my face relax into a brief grin.
"Leaf,"
I called, and he could not help but hear the relief in my voice.
"I'm glad you're here."
I'd forgotten I'd asked Hal to send him as soon as the sun set. "I hope you're dressed for a fight."
"A fight? Is that what I hear coming down the road?"
My vampire attorney stepped from the shadow of the porch into the dim glow of the streetlights. A white mane of hair floated around his pale face, which was scowling at me above an impeccably tailored suit, not dressed in his fighting togs then. The Firbolgs rounded the corner, and the noise of their approach became intimidating, even without the senses of a vampire. "I didn't intend this, Leaf," I said, "but if you don't help me now, you might not have your favorite client around anymore. There's 2 glasses in it for you."
"In addition to my fees?"
He raised his eyebrows. "No, 1 glass is your fee, the other is off the books for your help in this fight." There was no time to negotiate. He nodded once and said,
"They do not look very tough."
"They're giants using glamour, so don't trust your eyes. Use your other senses. What does their blood smell like?" They were almost upon us, but it was a worthwhile question. Leaf's eyes widened as he caught the scent of their blood.
"They are strong," he said. "Thanks, Atticus."
He grinned, his fangs lengthening as he smiled.
"I have not had my breakfast yet."
"Look at it like an all-you-can-eat buffet," I said. And then there was no more time for talking. Not one to be shy, Leaf launched himself in a superhuman leap against the leading Firbolg, far above where his head was, according to mortal eyes. That's because the giant's neck was actually about 3 feet higher, and the Firbolgs slowed down when they saw their leader taken down by a guy in an English business suit. But slowing down wasn't the same thing as stopping.
"Go, Oberon. Good hunting."
He loped away and I drew power from my front lawn, exulting in the feeling as it coursed through my cells after channeling through my ancient tattoos. The intricate knotwork traveled from the sole of my right foot up the outside of my ankle and right side until it snaked over my right pectoral muscles and around to the top of my shoulder, where it fell like an indigo waterfall to the middle of my biceps. There it looped around 5 times until it threaded down my forearm, ending, if Celtic knots can be said to end at all, in a loop on the back of my hand. The tattoos were bound to me in the most intimate way possible, and through them I had access to all the power of the earth, all the power I would ever need, so long as my bare foot touched the ground. In practice, that meant I would never, ever tire in battle. I suffered no fatigue at all, and if I needed it, I could whip up a binding or two against my enemies, or summon up a temporary burst of strength that would allow me to wrestle a bear. It had been a long, long time since I had felt the need to summon so much power. But then again, I hadn't been in a scrap like this since I'd waded into the mosh pit at a Pantera concert. 9 firbolgs. Well, 8 now. Were a few more than I had been expecting. I moved to put my mesquite tree behind my back as an obstacle in case any of them were thinking about surrounding me. Then I pointed my finger at the first firbolg to set foot on my lawn and said, "Connie!" Literally, hold or detain. And the earth moved to do my will. It gave way and then reformed around the firbolg's feet, rooting him abruptly and very firmly to the spot. To say he was surprised would be putting it mildly. With so much forward momentum, his bones had no choice but to break above the ankle when his feet were suddenly and inflexibly held in place. The bones ripped out through the back of his calf, and he flopped face down in front of me, sans feet and screaming. That was not the way I had envisioned things working out. I had hoped he would brace himself, keep his feet, and serve as a wall between me and the fellows behind him. No such luck. His buddies kept coming, enraged rather than cautioned by their comrade's fall, and I now had to deal with 3 spears thrusting at my vitals. Real fights don't look as pretty as the ones you see in movies. Those are choreographed, especially the martial arts ones, to seem so beautiful that they are practically dances. In true combat, you don't pause, pose, and preen. You just try to kill the other guy before he kills you. And winning ugly is still winning. That's what Bress failed to understand, and that's why I got rid of him so easily. Firbolgs have none of that pretentiousness. And even if they did, they would have lost it quickly after seeing Leaf take down their leader in the street, and then another one lose his feet in my lawn. No, these lads were betting that I wouldn't be able to dodge 3 spears thrust at me from a height from 3 different angles. I might be able to deflect one and dodge another, but the third one would get me. If I jumped straight up or back, I'd get tangled up with my own mesquite tree. If I rolled forward beneath their thrusts, they'd just stomp on my dumb ass. I was guessing these guys were pushing 600 pounds, so I didn't want to be in the middle of their clog dance. That meant I had less than a second to do some impossible shit. The ones on the left and the center had solid footing for their thrusts, but the one on the right had to plant his foot squarely on the back of his fallen, screaming, footless friend. So that was the one I was willing to take my chances with. I leapt to the left, leaving the ground, which they obviously did not expect. Since the lad on the right was out of reach, I slashed at the spearheads of the other two and was gratified to see Fragorak cleave through them easily. But it was too easy. The cut was so clean that while the heads careened off at an angle, the shafts continued on course, and so both of them caught me full force, one in the shoulder, one in the gut. They threw me backward to crack my back painfully against the trunk of my mesquite tree, and I had been planning such a graceful tuck and roll, too. The firbolg on the right had missed completely, his thrust stabbing the air where I had been, but he was stepping off his screaming friend's back and preparing for another thrust. "Kani," I said, pointing at him, and he unexpectedly found himself immobile. While he tried to figure out what to do about his captured feet, I returned my attention to the first two giants, who were now holding long wooden staves. I assumed that the other 4 firbolgs were anxious to get at me too, but perhaps Leaf and Oberon were keeping them busy. I saw nothing beyond my own personal battle. The one who had been the center attacker decided to steal the spear of his footless friend, since he wasn't doing anything except bleeding to death. As he bent down to retrieve it, the one on the left decided he would try playing golf with my head. Well, that was easy enough to deal with. I held out Fragorak in the path of his swing, and then I was able to spend a couple of seconds concentrating on the pain my tumble had caused. The blow to my shoulder had deeply bruised the muscle, and it wouldn't be much use until I healed it. The shot to my abdomen was much more serious. It had penetrated, though not through, to the intestines, and I was bleeding freely. As for my back, I was damn lucky I had not broken it. It was probably a chiropractor's wet dream, as it was. I wished I could do one of those ridiculous fairy godmother routines, where you just wave a wand, some sparkly lights fill your vision, and then everything is all better. But my magic doesn't work like that. I can start the healing process and accelerate it, and I can force my body to ignore pain, but I cannot simply make damage disappear. So I did what I could in 2 seconds. I activated the healing charm on my necklace, which blocked pain and put me firmly on the mend, and then I had to move. Golf Boy was getting ready to take another swing, his first one shortened a foot or so by Fragorak. The lad from the center now had his footless mate's spear and was ready to skewer me with it. The immobilized one had decided to throw his spear at me, off balance though he might be. It was time to take the offensive. I gathered myself into a crouch and then leapt, but this one was more like Leaf's. I put some earth power behind it, so I was fairly launching myself at the Firbolg's would-be Phil Mickelson. He saw my intent and raised his shield, but that was what I was counting on. I slashed down from right to left and followed through as I arrived, cutting cleanly through both his shield and his skull before crashing my right shoulder into the remainder of his shield and sliding back down to the earth with his crumpling body. The Firbolgs get my highest marks for battle savagery. The slain giant's fellows spared him not a single thought, but only looked for vulnerabilities my attack might have exposed. I had to whip Fragora back up across my body to deflect a thrown spear from the immobilized one, then back down to neutralize the thrust of the other.
"Connie!"
I said once more, and now the ladder was frozen in place too. I could safely move away to confront other threats and come back to finish them off later. Another of the Firbolgs had tried to flank me, but in doing so he had strayed too close to my house and activated the wards. He was busy fighting off some tangling bougainvillea vines that were trying to bring him to ground, and he wasn't enjoying the thorns. I spun around to the street, trying to get some perspective on the remaining foes, and saw that two more were down in the street. One was dismembered, and another had Leaf attached to his neck, and drinking deeply. There was one more, and this one was spinning around clumsily, counterclockwise, and stabbing at the ground at something unseen. It was Oberon, harrying the Firbolg's legs. I could not bear it if my friend was lost, so I sprang to help. I lopped off the giant's spear arm at the elbow the next time he spun around, and then I thrust Fragora underneath his ribs to end it.
"Thanks," Oberon said as the giant fell heavily into the street. "They have tougher skin than I thought. All I was able to do was tick them off."
"That was enough, my friend. Stay here while I take care of the stragglers." I cast camouflage on myself and my sword, and then I crept up behind the two immobilized Firbolgs and stabbed Fragora up into their kidneys. Cowardly? Blech. Tell you what, let's debate the meaning of honor and see who lives longer. The last Firbolg died in a mess of vines and blood, and only then did I relax the bindings of my lawn, allowing the earth to spit the giant's feet back up. I dropped my camouflage and swept the area with my eyes and my other senses, looking for additional threats, but all I saw were nine massive corpses and a whole lot of blood. The Firbolg's glamours had died with them, leaving me with a colossal cleanup problem. I didn't want to ask the earth to swallow these guys. I had asked so much of it already, and besides that, I doubted there would be time. I wasn't as fast as Flittish when it came to moving large amounts of earth, and I imagined someone had called the police by now. As if on cue, I heard sirens in the night air, and that drew my gaze to the parted living room blinds of my neighbor across the street, whose large round eyes were staring fearfully at me as if I somehow was the bad guy. Great. "Leaf?" I said. "Hey, Leaf, aren't you full yet?" my lawyer said, tearing himself away from his breakfast and belching softly.
"Very full. Thank you."
"Well, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, perhaps you could help me here. The police are on their way, and we have a lot of evidence to hide."
"Oh,"
the vampire said, seeming to remember suddenly that his job was to keep me out of jail. He looked down at his tailored English business suit, now stained with copious amounts of blood, and then back up at my shirt, which was rather bloody as well.
"Yes, it would appear that there is a lot of evidence to hide."
"Go inside and change real fast. There's a suit in my closet and you can grab me a fresh shirt," I said, pulling mine off and handing it to him. "Then come back and do your freaky memory thing with my neighbor across the street. He's the source of our police problem." Leaf moved with all the speed at his disposal. He knew he had a couple of minutes at most, probably less, before the police would arrive. In that time we had to make it look as if no one had died here tonight. I went back to my lawn and summoned some more power. It allowed me to drag 600-pound giant bodies quickly to the east side of my lawn, farthest from my driveway, and stack them on top of one another. The ones in the street would have to be Leaf's problem. The power stored in my bear charm would drain quickly if I tried to handle them alone. But what I could do was cast camouflage on all the bodies and the spreading pools of blood. Oh, and maybe I should conceal my sword, too. Nothing to see here, coppers. Move along. Leaf returned in a minute, wearing a suit I had bought at the men's warehouse.
So, did you like the way you looked wearing this?
He said, mocking the commercials as he tossed me a fresh T-shirt. It didn't fit him perfectly. It was tight across the chest, and he was a little longer of limb than I. He was a bloody Viking, after all. The sirens were awfully close.
You need to get those bodies out of the street and put them over there, I said, pointing to the pile I had made, and then take care of my neighbor's delusions.
No problem, he said,
and then he zipped out into the street and started tossing giants, being careful not to get blood on his hands. I pulled on the clean shirt and kept my eyes on the blinds across the street. My neighbor, Mr. Simurgian, had always been the snoopy sort. He had held me in deep suspicion from the day I moved in, because I did not own a car. I started casting camouflage on every spot of blood I could find, and then on the pile of bodies as well. Leaf ran across the street to lay some vampire hoodoo on Mr. Smurgian.
Look into my eyes, you didn't see anything.
It was like an old Jedi mind trick. I was fairly confident I had taken care of all visible evidence before the first patrol car rounded the corner. If they went snooping around the east side of my lawn, they would run into some major invisible evidence, but hopefully they would never have reason to do that. As they wailed down the street, I muttered a little something to magnify the scent of local plant life, which would hopefully mask the scent of so much spilled blood. I sent Oberon to sit quietly on our front porch while Leaf and I dealt with the authorities. He probably needed another bath anyway. Three black and whites pulled up to my house, alerting all my other neighbors that the noise they had been ignoring was something to worry about after all. Six officers jumped out of the cars and pointed guns at us over their car doors.
"Freeze!"
one of them shouted, even though we were standing perfectly still. Another one snarled,
"Hands above your head!"
And yet another said,
"Drop the sword!"
Chapter 11. How can one freeze and put their hands above their head at the same time? Do they teach cops to shout contradictory instructions at suspects at the academy for some sinister purpose? If I obeyed one cop, did the other cop get to shoot me for resisting arrest? The only one who worried me was the guy who told me to drop my sword. It was camouflaged, but still hanging in its scabbard across my back. Could he see through the camouflage?
"Good evening, gentlemen," Leaf said smoothly.
Neither of us raised our hands.
"I am an attorney for Mr. O'Sullivan here."
All the cops looked at him standing there serenely in his suit and got real quiet. "I am an attorney" is a trigger phrase for cops. It tells them they have to go slow and follow procedures or their case will get tossed out of court. It meant that they wouldn't be able to wave their guns around and bully me into anything. Unfortunately, it also told them that I needed an attorney at my house after normal business hours. If I were a mind reader, I would be hearing the same thing from each one of their heads. This bastard is so guilty he already has his lawyer here.
"What can we do for you tonight?" Leaf asked pleasantly.
"We received a call that there was someone cutting down people with a sword here," one of them said.
Leaf snorted in amusement. "A sword? Well, I suppose that's refreshing, perhaps even charmingly retro, but would there not be some signs of struggle if that were the case? People missing their arms, lots of blood, and maybe an actual sword in somebody's hand? You can see for yourselves that nothing like that is going on here. All is well. I think you received a crank call, officers."
"Then why are you here?"
the cop asked. "I'm sorry, officer,
It's Benton.
"Officer Benton, I am Leif Helgerson. I am here because Mr. O'Sullivan is not only my client, he's my friend. We were simply standing here enjoying the autumn evening and discussing baseball when you drove up and pointed your weapons at us. Speaking of which, isn't it about time you put those away? Neither of us is about to threaten you."
"Let me see your hands first,"
Officer Benton said. Leif slowly took his hands out of his pockets, and I did the same, raising them to shoulder height. "Look," Leif said, wiggling his fingers like they were jazz hands. "No swords."
Officer Benton scowled at him, but then he reluctantly put away his sidearm, and the other officers followed his example.
"I think we should take a look around, just to be thorough," he said, stepping around his car door and walking toward us.
You do not have probable cause to look around, Leif told him as he lowered his hands and crossed his arms. I put mine in my pockets.
The 911 call gave us probable cause, Benton countered.
A crank call that clearly has no basis in fact. The only disruption to the peace in this neighborhood tonight has been your sirens, and if you want to search my client's property, you should go get a warrant.
What is your client trying to hide? Benton asked.
It is not a matter of hiding anything, Officer Benton, Leif said. It is a matter of protecting my client against unreasonable search and seizure. You have absolutely no reason to search these premises. Your call described a sword fight in progress, but nothing like that has gone on here, so I think your time would be better spent protecting the city from real threats instead of imaginary ones. In addition, if the caller was the elderly Lebanese gentleman across the street, he has a long history of harassing my client over imagined trespasses. We are considering a restraining order against him.
Officer Benton looked supremely frustrated. He knew, he just knew I was hiding something. And of course he was right. But he wasn't used to dealing with lawyers. Detectives usually handled them. And he wasn't confident enough to proceed when he couldn't see anything wrong. Apparently the officer who had told me to drop the sword couldn't see it strapped to my back either, because he hadn't said a word since he got out of the car. He must have been shouting at me based on the 911 call. All hearsay. But Benton couldn't resist trying to bully me anyway.
"Haven't you got anything to say, mister?"
he sneered at me.
"Why did we get called out here?"
"Well," I said, "I cannot say for certain, of course, but it might be because Mr. Simurgian across the street there really doesn't like me. You see, about 3 years ago, my dog escaped and pooped on his lawn. I apologized and cleaned it up, but he's never forgiven me."
"Hey, I heard that,"
Oberon called from the porch.
"You told me to poop on his lawn."
"Yeah, so what's your point?" I asked.
"You're making it sound like I'm some ordinary dog who just poops anywhere."
"I know, but it's going to get that Simurgian guy in trouble."
"Oh, well, that's okay then. I don't like him."
Officer Benton glowered at me for a moment, and then at Leif. But if he was expecting us to confess, he was going to be disappointed.
"Sorry for disturbing you,"
he finally growled, and then thought to amend his tone.
"Have a nice night."
He turned his back on us and stalked across the street to Mr. Simurgian's house, muttering to two of the officers that they could go, he'd write it up. They made goodbye noises at him and climbed back into their cars, turning off their lights and motoring away as Officer Benton pounded on Simurgian's door.
"Should we worry about him remembering anything?" I whispered to Leif.
"No, he is still completely in my thrall," he replied in the same low tone.
"How are you planning to get rid of the Firbolgs?"
"I actually hadn't planned that far yet."
"You know, for another glass of that fine vintage you have, I can take care of it. Just help me haul them over to Mitchell Park."
I took time to consider. Burying the bodies of nine giants would not be easy, even if they were already in pieces. Calling on Radomiwa's coven to take care of it was a possibility, but I really didn't want to use up their favor on something like this.
"How would you take care of it?" I asked.
He shrugged.
"I know some ghouls. I make a couple calls, the guys come over for dinner, problem solved."
"They can put away nine whole giants? There's that many ghouls in town?"
"Probably not," Leif admitted. "But whatever they did not eat tonight, they'll take the rest to go."
I stared at him in disbelief. "You mean like a doggy bag?" The vampire nodded with a thin trace of a smile.
"They have a refrigerated truck, Atticus. These are practical guys. I employ them often, and so does Magnuson on occasion. It is a satisfactory arrangement for everyone."
"So I would owe you three glasses," I said.
"That is correct. And I want them sooner rather than later, since you are apparently marked for death."
"Hmm," I said, to buy myself some time. Officer Benton was writing out a citation for a bewildered Mr. Simurgian across the street. False calls to 911 are a no-no.
"Can I pay you one tonight for your firm and the other two tomorrow night?" I asked.
"Why not simply give them all to me tonight?" Leif replied. "You heal rapidly."
"Well, that's what I'm doing right now," I said.
I have some torn abdominal muscles, a deeply bruised left shoulder, and a couple of vertebrae are out of place.
Should you not be screaming in pain, then?
Leaf regarded me skeptically. Yes, but I've blocked my pain receptors, and I'm going to need my strength if I want to be good as new by morning.
What are the odds of you surviving until morning?
I think they're excellent. I was warned about the arrival of Bress and the Firbolgs, and both have now been dispatched.
Bress is dead? The former king of the Tuatha De Danann?
Manannan Mac Lir take me for a fool. I shouldn't have told him that. It was too late to backpedal, though. If I lied, he'd know it. Aye, he lost his head up the street moments before I arrived.
And you did it?
Guilty.
Then I want all three glasses tonight, Atticus, and to hell with your healing. Briot is going to kill you, and this will be my last drink.
I sighed heavily in defeat. I was not about to explain the details of my arrangement with the Morrigan to him. We wait for Officer Benton to leave, I said. Then you make your calls and we haul the bodies over to the park. Only after I'm in the clear and my front yard can pass inspection without camouflage will you get your rare vintage.
Agreed, the vampire said. I'm full right now anyway. I need to work some of this off.
He dug a cell phone out of his, or I should say my, breast pocket, and used a speed dial number to call someone named Antoine.
I have dinner for the whole crew at Mitchell Park in Tempe right now. Bring the truck.
Yes, there is enough for everybody. Trust me. See you there.
Whoa. He had ghouls on speed dial. My lawyer kicks so much ass.
Chapter 12.
Ugh. Yuck! Ugh!
I woke in my backyard, stiff from a night spent on the ground and itchy from the grass. Oberon was nestled around my legs, his head resting on my shin. I tried to gently extricate myself so he could continue sleeping if he wished. The night outside had been necessary to speed my healing, especially after surrendering 3 wine glasses of blood for Leaf. I had needed the contact with the ground and the power of the earth. Worth a bit of itching, definitely. I sat up and checked my abdomen. Some stiffness there, no real pain, and the skin had already scabbed over and fallen off, showing me a shiny new pink epidermis. The shoulder was good as new, and my back, while still a bit sore, at least felt like it was straight again. I grinned. After 2,100 years, I still thought magic was pretty damn cool. Oberon picked up his head as I got to my feet, and he took that as his cue to stand and stretch.
Morning, Atticus.
Morning. You want a belly rub? Better take it while I'm offering.
Okay.
He promptly flopped down next to me, lifting his front paws to give me better access. I squatted down and rubbed him vigorously for a few minutes while his tail thumped happily against my leg. So, what would you like for breakfast today?
Sausage.
You always say that.
That's because it's always tasty.
I'm out of sausage. How about some pork chops?
Well, I don't know. Did Genghis Khan eat pork chops?
Well, I doubt he ate chops, because that's a fairly modern way to cut it. He probably ate slices off a whole ham or something that they had roasted in the ground all day.
Can I have some of that, then?
I don't have a whole pig to roast, nor do I have the time to do it properly. Can't you settle for some chops and just pretend?
All right. But after that, can we conquer Siberia or something?
Not today, Oberon. I chuckled. I have a contract to fulfill with the witches, and someone is bound to come by and threaten me today, or try to kill me. And we have to make sure the widow is okay. We left her house rather abruptly last night. I rose from my haunches and brushed the grass off my shorts. Come on, let's go inside and make breakfast.
All right, but I think we should start recruiting a horde now and have them muster on the Mongolian steppes. We can join them in the spring and then ride to glory.
Where are we going to recruit a horde? I asked him as we stepped inside. Frogara was lying where I left it on the kitchen table.
Well, I don't know. You're the bloody druid here, not me. But I think you should start with getting me a sufficient number of French poodles, and you can find those in the classified section of the newspaper. Hold on, I'll go get it.
No, no, don't go out there, I said. You're still in hiding, remember? I'll go get it. I wanted to see what could be seen in the daylight anyway. I dissolved the camouflage bindings on my lawn to evaluate the signature of last night's carnage. There were some messy patches of gore we had missed last night, a especially on the eastern side, and I pulled out the garden hose to see how much of it I could spray away. Most of it obligingly melted into the soil under a jet stream, but some of the grass remained tinted an unhealthy shade of pink. That was a problem I couldn't simply camouflage away, because the only thing around the pink grass was more pink grass. I'd have to come up with an excuse if anyone asked. Maybe that giant animated jar of Kool-Aid met its untimely end here. Other than pinkness, there was no evidence of the violent demise of 9 very large creatures. I scooped my newspaper off the driveway and returned to the house, where Oberon was waiting with his tail wagging.
"Any French poodles for sale?"
he asked hopefully. "I haven't had a chance to look yet," I laughed. We discussed the logistics and supply we'd need for our invasion of Siberia as I made a pot of coffee for us and 2 separate entrees, a skillet full of chops and melted butter for Oberon, and a cheese and chive omelet for myself. I also toasted a slice of whole wheat bread and slathered it with butter and blackberry preserves. It was domestic bliss there for a while, with the sound of our breakfast cooking, mourning doves cooing in the backyard, and a conversation that was little more than an exercise in silliness. Oberon's ability to distract me from life's worries was one of the reasons I adored him. But then I sat down at the kitchen table with my food and looked at the newspaper, and the worries came back. There was a follow-up story on the death of the ranger. The headline said, "Ranger Death Caused by Canine," and a subhead said, "Police Following Several Leads." The food I had been intent on savoring got shoveled into my mouth mechanically as I read. Phoenix. Lab reports revealed that the death of Phoenix Park Ranger Alberto Flores was caused by a canine, and not by a knife wound as originally believed. Dr. Eric Mellon, Maricopa County Coroner, discovered that Flores's throat wounds bore signs of tearing associated with teeth. DNA tests on samples collected from the wound detected the presence of canine saliva. That evidence, along with several dog hairs found underneath Flores's fingernails and other clues, according to Phoenix detective Carlos Jimenez, have led police to believe that he was attacked and killed by a large dog, possibly an Irish wolfhound. "They got that lab report back awfully fast," I said aloud, and Oberon asked me what I was talking about. "They're on your trail, buddy," I gestured at the newspaper. "They know a dog killed the ranger. How they know an Irish wolfhound did it, I have no idea. As far as I know, there isn't a test to isolate breeds. I bet you the police are getting help from someone." Oberon's ears pricked up, and he swiveled his head toward the front room.
"Someone is coming to knock on the door,"
he said. "Don't bark," I told him silently. "Don't make a sound or do anything to indicate you're here. I'm going to camouflage you again." And then 4 sharp knocks echoed through the house. I quickly cast camouflage on Oberon before walking noisily to the front door. Pausing to look through the keyhole, I saw 2 men standing there in shirts and ties. I turned on my fairy specs, but there was nothing to see. They were humans then, either cops or missionaries. Since it was Sunday morning and all the missionaries would be on their way to church, I was betting on cops. I opened the door and stepped out quickly, taking them by surprise and forcing them to step back a little bit. I closed the door behind me and smiled winningly at them. "Good morning, gentlemen," I said. "How may I help you?" I kept my hands in plain sight at my sides, doing my best to appear friendly and harmless. I also stepped a bit to the left so that they would be facing away from the pink grass. The cop to my right wore a blue shirt with a striped tie in navy and white. He wore a jacket to conceal his firearm, certainly not to keep warm, and I got the feeling he would rather walk around with his gun in plain view. He was Latino, looked to be in his mid-30s, and carried a bit of extra gravity in his jowls. On the left was the lad assigned to look dumber and meaner. He was going for a Michael Madsen attitude, wearing polarized sunglasses and leaning against my porch railing with his arms crossed. I guessed he wouldn't be talking much. He was even younger than the other guy and wore a white shirt and skinny black tie, no jacket, like a refugee from a Tarantino film. He was scowling at me because I had stepped out onto the porch before they could ask to come in, which took away one of their primary methods for putting me on the defensive. If they can force you to run around playing the host, then they get a chance to snoop while you serve them. The Latino guy answered me, as expected.
"Mr. Atticus O'Sullivan?"
"The same."
"I'm Detective Carlos Jimenez from the Phoenix Police, and this is Detective Darren Fagles from the Tempe Police. May we speak to you inside?"
"Ha! He has to come inside anyway. Not gonna happen, buddy.
Oh, it's such a nice morning. Let's just talk out here, I said. What brings you to my door today?
Jimenez frowned. Mr. O'Sullivan, this is really best discussed in private.
We're plenty private right here, I grinned at him.
Unless you're planning to shout. You aren't going to shout at me, are you?
Well, no,
the detective admitted.
Great. So why are you here?
Resigned, Detective Jimenez finally got to the point.
Do you own an Irish wolfhound, Mr. O'Sullivan?
Nope.
Animal Control says you have one licensed under the name of Oberon.
That's true, I do. Well done, sir.
So then you do own one?
Nope. He ran away last week. I have no idea where he is.
So, where is he?
Didn't I just say I have no idea? Detective Jimenez sighed and pulled out a notebook and a ballpoint pen.
When precisely did he run away?
Last Sunday. That would be a week ago, as I said. I came home from work and he was gone.
What time was that?
5:15 p.m. Time to play the bewildered citizen.
Why are you asking about my dog?
Jimenez ignored my question and asked me another one.
When did you leave for work that day?
At 9:30.
And where do you work?
At Third Eye Books on Ash Avenue, just south of University.
Where were you on Friday night?
I was here at home.
Was anyone with you?
Well, that can hardly be any of your business.
It's precisely my business, Mr. O'Sullivan.
Oh. Are you going to tell me what this is about now?
We are investigating a murder committed Friday night in Papago Park.
I frowned and squinted at him. Am I a suspect? I didn't do it.
Do you have an alibi?
I wasn't in Papago Park Friday night. Isn't it supposed to be closed at night?
Who saw you Friday night?
No one. I was home alone reading.
With your dog?
No, not with my dog. He ran away last Sunday, remember? You wrote it down in your little book.
Would you mind if we verify that your dog is not at home?
How do you mean?
We'd like to take a look in your backyard and your house to make sure he's not at home.
Sorry, I'm not entertaining house guests today, especially ones who assume I'm lying.
We can come back with a warrant, Mr. O'Sullivan,
Detective Fagel said, speaking up for the first time. I turned my head to glare at him.
I'm well aware, Detective.
If you'd like to waste your time, go right ahead. My dog is not here, nor will he be here if you come back. Why are you looking for my dog anyway? What led you to my door?
We're not at liberty to discuss details of the investigation, Jimenez said.
It sounds like a pretty good one. Colonel Mustard did it in the park with the wolfhound, huh? I can hardly believe you'd be checking every single wolfhound owner in the valley. If you heard I still had a wolfhound from my neighbor across the street, he's not exactly a reliable witness. Last night he was cited by Officer Benton of the Tempe PD for making a false 911 call. The two detectives exchanged a glance, and I knew that was it. Mr. Samerjian was at it again. I'd have to ask Oberon to leave him a present on his front doorstep. He'd do it camouflage, too, so that even if Mr. Samerjian was watching, and he probably would be, it would appear to be undeniable physical evidence that sometimes shit just happens.
Have you checked the animal shelter for your lost dog, Mr. O'Sullivan? Jimenez asked.
Fagels went back to glaring at me from behind his sunglasses. Not yet, I said.
Aren't you concerned about his welfare?
Of course I am. He's properly licensed and has my phone number on a tag around his neck. I'm expecting a call any minute. They stared at me stone-faced for a few moments to let me know that the sarcasm wasn't appreciated. I stared back to let them know I wasn't intimidated. Your move, youngsters. I could tell they didn't quite know what to make of me. Seeing the world through a perp filter as they did, I must look to them like a sullen stoner punk pretending to attend college. But I wasn't behaving like one. I was too alert, too sharp. Maybe that made me a dealer. Perhaps they assumed I wasn't letting them in because they'd find my hydroponic weed operation and psychedelic mushrooms in the closet. Or maybe a 3-foot-tall bong made of blown glass and day-glow hippie colors sitting on the coffee table. Finally, Jimenez broke the silence. He gave me a business card and said,
"We'd like you to call us if you find your dog."
I took the card and slipped it into my pocket without looking at it. "Good day, gentlemen," I said, giving them a broad hint to get the hell off my porch. Jimenez took the hint, but Fagles remained. Apparently he wanted to have a staring contest or mutter a threat to me. What an idiot. I knew how to be patient. I put my hands in my pockets and flashed him a fake smile. That got a reaction. He uncrossed his arms, pointed a finger at me, and said, "We'll be watching." "Please, whatever." I kept on smiling and said nothing. Jimenez paused in the street and turned around, that being the point where he was supposed to realize Fagles hadn't followed him off the porch. "Detective Fagles, we have other people to talk to," he called. What a lovely straight line. Keeping his voice pitched for my ears only, Fagles said, "Yeah, like the judge." Gods below, did this routine work on anyone? With one last aggressive clenching of his jaw, Fagles turned and stepped off the porch. As he did, he turned his head toward the east side of the lawn, where all the pink grass was. Just looking around. No reaction. The grass probably didn't look pink through those tinted sunglasses of his. "Good job, detective." Jimenez was oblivious as well. He was watching me to see if my body language screamed, "Guilty!" Then he strolled unhurriedly to their unmarked Crown Victoria once Fagles had caught up. I returned inside once they had driven off, and Oberon nuzzled my hand at once.
"I was quiet,"
he said, very pleased with himself. I chuckled and scratched him behind the ears. "Yes, you were. Genghis Khan would have admired your craftiness." I lifted the camouflage off him so that he would feel comfortable, and then I sat back down to a half-eaten, lukewarm omelet and a cup of coffee I had to warm up to make palatable. After cleaning up, I set about looking for anything the cops would find incriminating, should they come here with a warrant. They would be supposedly searching for a dog, but that wouldn't stop them from snooping around either, unless I had a lawyer here. Even then, they might stumble across something or damage something in the process of their search that I didn't want them to, mostly my books. I had some pretty arcane titles behind glass in my study, with paper so old it was ready to crumble. Cops wouldn't be gentle with those if they wanted to rifle through them. I'd need to pay Hal $350 an hour to camp here and make sure they didn't look for Oberon inside my books. What a pain in the ass. Well, they should owe me some time after all that blood I gave Leaf last night. That battle had taken much less than an hour, and the cleanup lasted maybe another, so I should be paid up for 10 hours already. Speaking of blood, I put the scrap of paper with Radomiwa's blood on it inside an old collection of stories about the Fianna, and locked it away in the glass bookcase in my study. To be safe, I camouflaged my herbs in the backyard so it looked like I had nothing along my fence but empty shelves. No telling what the cops would think about all the plant life back there. They'd probably assume some of it must be illegal and confiscate the lot of it to have it analyzed, and I'm sure it would come back to me half dead or worse. Fagles would do it just to get back at me for staring him down. While it was a load of inconvenience, I couldn't get myself too angry with them. They were only doing their jobs, and after all, I really was the bad guy in this case, or at least Oberon was. Satisfied that I had hidden what needed hiding, I put in a call to Hal on his cell phone and explained my extraordinary needs for a Sunday. If Jimenez could get a warrant on Sunday, then I could get a lawyer. Hal said he'd send over a junior associate to guard the castle. "Is he a PAC member?" I asked.
"Yes. Does that matter?"
"Just tell him to keep a sharp ear and nose out. If one of my pantheon is behind this, then there might be some magical skullduggery going on. The police might bring someone along who isn't entirely human, for example."
"They probably won't show up at all. I never heard of a search warrant for a dog. You may be the most paranoid man I've ever met."
"I'm certainly the longest lived you've ever met."
"Point taken. I'll tell him."
I showered and dressed, cast camouflage back on Oberon, and slung Fragora across my back. I was anxious to visit the widow's house and make sure she was okay. Nothing looked amiss from the street. The blood had washed away or soaked into the asphalt sufficiently. Going around to the back, I saw nothing, not so much as a disturbed patch of ground. With a shudder, I considered the likelihood that the Morrigan had eaten him. Shaking my head to clear the grisly image, I walked back to the front, Oberon panting softly behind me. I knocked on the widow's front door, and she answered after a minute, looking spry and chipper.
"Ah, me dear boy Atticus, 'tis a pleasure to see ye again, and that's no lie. Have you killed any more Brits for me?"
"Good morning, Mrs. McDonough. No, I haven't killed any more Brits. I hope you won't be talking about that with anyone."
"Tish, Do you think I'm daft? I'm not there yet, thank the Lord. It's all due to clean living and good Irish whiskey. Would you be having some with me? Come on in.
She opened the screen door and beckoned. No, thank you, Mrs. McDonough. It's not yet 10 in the morning, and it's Sunday.
And don't I know it? I have to be going to Mass soon enough at the Newman Center. But the father can drone on at times, and he keeps preaching to the youngsters what go there, all those ASU kids, you know, who have those merry sins of the flesh to worry about. So I find a finger or two of the Irish helps me bear it with patience.
Wait, you go to church drunk?
Mellow is the word I'd be using, if you please.
You don't drive there, Mellow, do you?
Of course not.
She looked affronted.
I get a ride from that nice Murphy family what lives down the street.
Oh, well, that's fine then. I just wanted to make sure you were all right, Mrs. McDonough. I have to go to work now, so you can go, get Mellow and enjoy your day. Peace be with you.
And also with you, my boy. Are you sure I can't convince you to get baptized?
Quite sure, I said. But thank you again for the offer. Bye now.
Atticus?
Oberon said as he trotted behind my bike once we were safely on the way to the store.
What's baptize mean?
It means a priest dunks you in some water, and when you come out, you're reborn.
Really? So if I got baptized, I'd be a puppy again?
No, you're not literally reborn in the physical sense. It's a symbolic thing. Your spirit is supposed to be reborn because you're washed clean of sins. Oberon took 20 yards or so to consider this, his nails clicking on the sidewalk as we turned right on University Drive.
But the water just gets your skin and fur wet, right? How can it wash your spirit clean, especially without soap?
Like I said, it's symbolic, and it's a different belief system.
Oh, like going to church drunk is really going to church mellow.
I laughed. Yeah, kinda like that. I put Frogera on a shelf underneath my apothecary counter, let Oberon circle around a few times and get himself settled, and then opened the door for Perry, who looked appropriately gloomy for a goth guy this morning. Sundays at the shop were usually decent business, as if all the non-Christians wanted to make a point of buying something pagan while everyone else was in church. You could always tell the ones who had been raised in a strict Christian environment. They'd put their books on Wicca or Aleister Crowley down on the counter and grin nervously, amazed at themselves for having the stones to buy something their elders told them not to buy. And their auras almost always churned with arousal, which I did not understand when I first opened the shop, but eventually it made sense. For the first time in their lives, they were going to read about a belief system where it was okay to have sex, and they could hardly wait for the validation. By the same token, you could always spot the ones who were a part of the serious magical community. They had auras that shouted their mojo, for one thing, but they also wore one of three expressions on their faces when looking at the magical wannabes buying their first pack of tarot cards. They either sneered contemptuously, grinned faintly in amusement, or looked nostalgic for a time when they themselves were clueless. Emily, the snotty witch, was the contemptuous, sneering sort. She stormed into the shop dressed like a pampered horror from Scottsdale and promptly stuck her tongue out at me.
"Emily!"
A voice snapped from the open door before I could say anything. A frowning woman stepped in after the classic parenting reprimand, "Just shout the kid's name in public and let the tone do the work." And Emily's eyes widened a bit. She knew she was in trouble. Chapter 13. I assumed that the frowning woman must be Malina Sokolovsky. She looked to be in her early 30s, but if Emily was the youngest of Radomila's coven, then Melina's real age had to be pushing a century or more. She was a true blonde, with pale yellow hair cascading past her shoulders and soft waves that shampoo companies like to put in commercials. It looked glossy, fragrant, and utterly mesmerizing. It fell onto a squarely cut red wool coat, which would be too warm to wear for another month or so, but which provided a magnificent contrast in both color and texture. At that point, my amulet shut the noise down and I snapped out of it. Oh, she had some kind of beguilement charm on her hair. It was something the wards on my shop weren't designed to take care of, but the cold iron of my amulet caused it to fizzle. That meant it was not the everyday sort of witch's magic. Cool. Scary, but cool. Her hair really did look good, but now I was able to look away from it and assess the rest of her. Pale eyebrows, just a shade or two darker than her hair, and now drawn together in disapproval, provided a roof for a pair of startlingly blue eyes. She had a patrician nose and what looked like a generous mouth, but now it was drawn tightly down, lips painted to match the color of her coat. Pale skin. Not the unhealthy pallor of Goths, but the white porcelain sheen of European nobility stretched over a faint blush, made a pillar of her neck, which betrayed a hint of a gold necklace before it disappeared underneath her coat. Nonverbal signals are so powerful at times that I wonder at our need to speak. Without looking at her aura, I already knew that Melina was classy, where Emily was not. Far more mature, intelligent, and powerful, and was reluctant to give offense where Emily could not wait to give it. And I also knew she was more dangerous by several orders of magnitude.
"I thought I had made it clear you were to offer no offense to Mr. O'Sullivan," she said.
Her Polish accent was more pronounced than it had been on the phone, perhaps owing to her irritation. Emily lowered her eyes and muttered an apology.
"I'm not the one who needs an apology. It is Mr. O'Sullivan you have insulted. Apologize to him this instant."
Wow. She was scoring points with me already. But then I remembered that she was a witch, and they might have planned this whole scene ahead of time. Still, Emily looked as if she would rather mate with a goat than apologize to me, so I was enjoying it, even if it was a performance. Other customers were looking around at Melina's raised voice, their gazes lingering on the two women. They were difficult to look away from, albeit for very different reasons. When Emily took too long, Melina's voice lowered to a threatening growl so that only Emily and I could hear.
"If you do not apologize to him right now, then I swear by the three Zorias that I will measure your length on this floor and put you in breach of contract. You are in so much trouble already, you will be cast out from the coven."
Apparently, that was worse than mating with a goat, because Emily suddenly could not be more sorry for her behavior and hoped I would forgive her discourtesy. "I accept your apology," I said at once, and the tension in their shoulders eased. Melina finally turned her attention to me.
"Mr. O'Sullivan, I am so embarrassed by our entrance. I hope you will forgive me as well. I am Melina Sokolovsky."
She smiled brightly and extended a hand to me, gloved, I noticed, in brown leather, and I shook it once. "Forgiven," I said. "Though there's really nothing to forgive. You're welcome to look around if you like, or if you'd simply rather wait for the tea, you can sit at one of the tables over there while I make it."
"That's very kind, thank you,"
Melina replied. "It'll just be a couple of minutes."
"Great."
She gestured toward the tables and gently pushed Emily in that direction.
"After you, miss," she said.
"I like the blonde one. She knows how to show respect,"
Oberon said from behind the counter. I busied myself making Emily's tea and spoke to him through our link. "Yes, well, she's decided to take the high road, so I'll be happy to walk it with her as long as she likes."
"You don't trust her?"
"Nope. She's a witch. A polite witch, but still a witch. She's got a charm on her hair that would have had me giving her anything she wanted if I hadn't been wearing protection. Don't take anything from her, by the way."
"You think she's going to pull a sausage out of her coat or something? She doesn't even know I'm here."
"Oh, yes, she does. Emily has probably already told her."
"Okay, fine. But seriously, you think she has a magic sausage for me?"
"How would you know the difference if she did? You think all sausages are magic?" Serving Emily her tea was quite nearly magical for me. I set it down in front of her and she drank it straight down, despite its heat, without making eye contact. When she was finished, she rose from her chair, said, "Excuse me," and left the shop without another word. "That was great," I said to Melina. "Can you come with her every day?" Melina chuckled throatily, then clapped a hand over her mouth.
"No, I shouldn't laugh. It's just that I empathize with you. She is not well behaved."
"So what's she doing hanging out with you?" Melina sighed.
"That is a very long story."
"Haven't you heard? I'm a druid. I like long stories." The witch looked around. There were still quite a few customers in the store, and someone scruffy had walked up to my apothecary counter and was squinting at the labels on my jars.
"Well, you have a lovely place here," Melina said. "I do not think it is the right time for such a story."
"What, you mean the customers? Perry'll take care of them." I walked to the counter and put a closed tent sign significantly in front of the scruffy man.
"Whoa, man. You're closed?"
He frowned at me, but was not to be deterred. He had something on his mind.
"Hey, dude, you got any medical marijuana back there?"
"No, sorry." These guys just wouldn't leave me alone.
"It's not for me, I swear. It's for my grandma."
"Sorry. Try back next week."
"Hey, really?"
"No." I turned my back on him, pulled up a chair next to Melina, and plastered an attentive look on my face. "You were telling me why you tolerate Emily in your coven?" Scruffy weed man interrupted before she could answer.
"You have really beautiful hair,"
he said to Melina. She looked annoyed and told him curtly to go away, and he promptly turned and exited the store. Pretending to be self-conscious, she pulled at a lock of her hair near her shoulder and muttered something under her breath, no doubt dispelling the charm. She'd forgotten she had it on. I pretended not to know.